2005. I am in the home of Mr. Leroy Jones, known as Roy Jones, and I am recording an interview for the Chincoteague Island Library History Project. Mr. Jones, we're interested in learning about your past in living in Chincoteague, and I understand that you were born on Assateague.
I was born on Chincoteague.
Oh, on Chincoteague.
But my parents moved to Assateague when I was 1 year old, and I lived there for 13 years. And then we moved to Chincoteague. And my little sister, she was the last person born on Assateague.
And what year was that?
She was born in 31. 1931. She was the last person born there.
About that. Can you tell us a little bit what it was like to grow up on Assateague?
Well, from today's standards, it was what we would call primitive living, you know, because the majority of the people on Chincoteague at that time, it was all a matter, you know, of primitive living. Because when I was living on Assateague, I could look over toward Chincoteague, and they were working on the water tank, you know.
Uh-huh.
So people caught the water. A lot of people had shallow wells. Some of them caught rainwater, and it was stored in cisterns. Uh-huh. On Assateague, we got our water from my grandfather's well. It was a big well, you know. And I had a bucket on a long pole, and we'd put the bucket down and dip it up. And the water was good. It was unmarried. And the other places, they had petromouth pumps, you know, shallow well. And you just went down with the handle. The back in 1764, there were 27 people living on Assateague.
1924.
In 1764, there are only 27 people living on Assateague. And at the peak of the population, which was before 1900, there were 250. We were one of the last ones to leave the island. The people, they had wood-burning stoves, and you could go in the forest and get your wood. Mm-hmm. That didn't cost anything. The water in the well didn't cost anything. And nights, when you extinguished the kerosene-burning lamp, all of your expenses ceased. Mm. But the people had a, we might call it a primitive life, but it was a good life. We could get any kind of a seafood that we wanted. If you wanted a mess of fish, we didn't have refrigeration. You could just go out in the channel and in a few minutes catch a mess of fish. When you got enough for a mess, you just came ashore, cleaned them, and cooked them. If you had more than you could use for one meal, we could salt them down. Because occasionally we would get a half of a cake of ice, which would be, I don't know, maybe 100 pounds. And you could put it in a wooden box and cover it up with canvas or anything, and you could have ice, you know, the rest of the week. Mornings, we had to get an open boat and go across the channel to east side. When it was rough and the spray would beat over the side of the boat, if it was real cold, well, the spray would freeze on us. And I've gone to school a many morning, and go down in the furnace room where it was warm and the ice would melt, you know, off the back of my coat. Today, all the students have to do is stand alongside the street. And we had to walk from east side. The school then was there on Church Street.
Right.
And today, my sister's son, he had to go from his front steps out to the edge of the street, and he thought that was terrible. I said, how about if you had to do what your Uncle Roy did? But it was,
came by boat to Chincoteague, and then you would walk on to school.
That's right. Now, the school bus would pass us, but they couldn't pick us up because we didn't live on Chincoteague.
Oh, okay.
My daddy was born and raised on Astig. My grandfather was born and raised on Astig. And far as I know, my great-grandfather was born and raised on Astig. And the little community, you go over there today, and you would see no signs that a community had ever been there. They moved a lot of houses from Astig to Chincoteague on barges. Right down the street from me is one house that came from Astig. And over there where Church Street Supply is today, right that way or that, there's three or four houses that was moved off of Astig. Over here at East Side is three or four houses that were moved from Astig. The church that was on Astig, they moved that off on the barge. And when they got it over East Side, they took the bell tower off. And they built a little room on the back. And people are still living in that. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a few houses on here that came from Astig.
Now, would they have been moved over at the same time, or is it one by one?
One by one.
They move over and decide to locate in Chincoteague?
Yeah.
Okay.
The reason that the houses, most of them are on Astig, because when they brought the house over on the barge, it was just a short distance. Just move them across the street and put them right on the lot. Now, the one down the street, they had to take that a little bit further. Now, the ones over there by Church Street Supply, well, they had to move them from East Side over almost to the Baptist Church. So that was farther to move them. And the people that lived over there, the children, they didn't have all of these modern gadgets, you know. We had to make our own toys. We could go swimming. We could go catching crabs. And the boys over there and the boys that lived at East Side, the first thing we learned to do was scull a boat. You never see anybody sculling a boat now because you don't have to. Just about everybody works on the water has outboard motors. But on the stern of the boat was a half moon cut out of the transom. And you put your oar in that half moon. And it was just a matter of, just like I'm doing, of twisting your wrist.
Back and forth.
And every time you twist your wrist, that oar would cut into water. It would be a pressure on that oar, and it propels your boat ahead. People that try to do it put their oar flat like this and go back and forth. That won't do it. You go like that and like that. And every time you do like that and you pull the oar, that put a pressure against that blade. And when you learned how to scull a boat, you thought you were getting up. Then you learned to tie a clove hitch. A lot of people call them two half hitches. That's the way you made your boat fast to a piling or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you learned how to tie half hitches, and you learned how to scull. And we thought we were, more grown up. One day I had a 23-foot flat bottom work scull, and I was working at the Marine Railway, and I was taking my boat from, I lived out here on Main Street, and I was taking my boat up to the railway to follow it, run the railway. So Roy says, "Bring your boat up. We've got to pull another small boat up. We can pull them both up on one cradle, and you can overhaul it." I said, "Okay." And I was going along. So it was some fellas coming up the channel in a 8-board boat, and I heard one of the men say, "What is he doing?" You know, what is he doing? And the fellow says, he's sculling his boat up. So it's like I say, it's an art in it. It's simple. It's just like a figure eight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a twist of the wrist. And when you twist it one way and pull your oar, you twist it and you shove it. And then, almost anybody can learn how to row a boat. You just put your two oars in the water and pull.
Mm-hmm.
But sculling is a little bit more complicated until you once learn. And after you once learn, I don't think you'd ever forget. I expect it's been 25 years since I sculled a boat, but I could stick a oar and scull and hold like a scull, just like swimming.
Mm-hmm.
I know one day I was getting some shells out of the pump box on a little barge, and I had hip boots on, and I don't know what happened, but I went overboard head first into slip, you know. I didn't have time think about how to swim. I just swam. So there are some things you don't forget. To say you never forget how to ride a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, getting on back to Astig, things that I did to pass away the time, like I said, we made our dog, we'd find a piece of white pine, and we'd make what we call a propeller or a windmill, you know.
Oh.
And I played with the lighthouse keeper's daughters.
Do you remember their names?
It was Ruth Collins and Margaret Collins. Now, their older sister, I didn't play with her. She was a little bit older. Her name was Ada.
Oh, okay.
And outside of the three, I know one of the three Collins girls had passed away. I don't know whether any of the other ones are living or not. But outside of those Collins girls, I'm just about the only one left that knows much about Astig. Now, Frank Williams, his grandmother and grandfather lived on Astig. And occasionally they would come over there. So Frank knows much about Astig. But I'm the only one that knows how the village was in 1925.
And that was the date of your birth? Was that when you were born?
No, I was born in 1919. But
okay.
I can remember when I was 6 years old.
Uh-huh, sure.
And I've made several sketches. I'm not an artist.
Oh.
But I've made several sketches of the village as it was in 1925.
Wow.
And you could look at that sketch and then go over there and look today, and you say, well, I can't believe it was ever here. Because where the schoolhouse was, well, the little schoolhouse is gone, and the church, they moved that, and people are still living in that over on the east side.
Right.
And like I said, there are several other buildings that mm-hmm. people are living in that was moved from Assateague.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit more about your family. Well, what did your dad do? And
my daddy was born and raised on Astig. He worked on the water all of his life. A lot of people that lived on Astig, they would go down to Tom's Cove and clam. And then a lot of them would go down what we call down the bay. And they would go from here as far south as Smith Island. And Smith Island is almost down to the Capes, because when you come across the bridge tunnel,
right,
you can look over to your right and you can see Smith Island Lighthouse.
Ah.
So people have gone from here down to Smith Island, oystering and clamming. There was a time you could take a down the bay boat and a barge. Of course, you had your work scows.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, four head could load 1,000 bushel monitor.
Wow.
And today, I don't expect there's 1,000 bushels of oysters from here to the Capes.
Oh, my goodness.
60 years ago, well, the ones lived on Astig and the ones lived on Shanktig. 90% of the people got us living out of the inland waters, mm-hmm, and out of the ocean. Now, I never did make a dollar out of the ocean. But nearly all my life I've worked on the water and the inland waters. So, there was a fellow some time ago, his name is Donnie Thornton, and he has the Pine Grove Campground.
Yes,
He says, I was talking with him one day right out here, and he said, sometime when you have chance, take a piece of paper and write down the names of the down-to-bay boats that you can remember.
Wow.
That was to this island.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with over 100. And I know what every boat looked like. You know, I'm not an artist, but in my mind, I know what every one of them looked like.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have made several little model down the bay boats, you know. Because the young people today, you talk about a down the bay boat, and they don't know what you're talking about.
No.
And if the weather was warm, you would make a one-week trip. You'd leave on Monday morning, and you would come back most of the time Friday morning, sometimes Thursday morning.
And your crew would be about how many people?
Anywhere from 4 to 6. I had been down the bay where it is 8 head aboard the boat, but that's a little bit too many.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather was warm, like say you work 1 week and come home.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather was cool, like when you called signing clams, have you folks ever been signing clams?
No, I don't think so.
Well, when you sign clams, there are certain times a year when they call it, the clams will sign. And they have, I guess it's a dozen different clam signs. Most of the people look for, I've seen clams signing so good, it looked just like a keyhole in one of those old-timey locks.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh. The skeleton key would fit in.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them signing so good that the sign would be open so much you could look right down and see the edge of the clam. Well, when you did that, you would stay 2 weeks, but we call laying over Sunday.
So let me just picture this. The tide's out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the mud flats, you can see these little signs.
Now, there's the keyhole.
Uh-huh.
Now, on what we call the rocks, which, when I say rock, it isn't stone. It's the rocks were a mixture of turf, sand, and shells.
Mm-hmm.
And how those rocks form, nobody knows. But that's when you were what they call rock clamming, and that's where you had these keyholes. And then it was another type of clamming we called flat clamming. It was just a smooth flat that it would be dry on the low tide. And then when the tide came up, it would be waist deep water. And they had, when you were flat clamming, there was one sign, particularly over here at Tom's Cove, was called a blue spot. I've seen clams in Tom's Cove signing by a blue spot, and it looked like you had, the sand would be sort of tan looking. And if you took taken a little dab of blue paint and painted a little blue spot on the flat. I've seen them showing some plain with blue sign for now. You can see the sign from here at that door.
Wow.
And that was the blue sign. There was the keyhole. There was the little round hole. There was what we called a sink. It looked like you just took your finger and pressed down in the bottom.
So it was indented.
Then there's the crawl sign. Sometimes a clam would, I guess he'd take a notion to move from where he was. And he could come out of the bottom, and he could move right along, right slow. And I've seen him crawl 3 feet. And where he was moving along, it'd be like a little trench. You know what I mean? And then you could see where he buried, and the sand would be kind of like puffed up, you know. So, it's all kinds of signs. Most people, when they go climbing, sign and climb, they just look for the keyhole. Now, like say, when you were rock climbing, that's just about all it was the keyhole. But flat climbing, they had the different signs. There was no art to catching a clam, but you had to have very good vision. As the old saying, you had to have an eagle eye. I never was too good at signing on the flat, but I could sign on the rock. So it's like I say, my daddy was born and he was raised on Astig. And he came over to Chincoteague, and that's where he met my mother. And then he lived on Chincoteague for a couple of years, I guess. I was only a year old when I moved back to Astig. Now, my two sisters and my brother, they were born on Astig. I had one brother, and he was killed in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. He was only 20 years old. So the people on, well, see, the wildlife condemned the land on Astig. And most people had to get off. My grandfather owned a lot of land on Astig. But there was 8 head of children. And when they took it over, land was cheap anyway. And his part was very, very meager. And the house that my grandfather lived in, when you come across Maddox Boulevard and you come to the intersection, it's right, you know where the drugstore is.
H&H.
When you come to the intersection of H&H, you make a left turn, and my grandfather's house is right on the right, right on the left when you're going up.
On Deep Hill Hole Road.
On deep, right on the corner of Deep Hole Road.
Okay.
Yeah. They've put a lot, they've added a lot on the front of it, but you can still see the gable part, you know. So that's where my grandfather lived, and that's where he raised all of his children.
And he had eight children.
At eight. And I sometimes wonder, how did they how did they raise 8 children? Well, that was my grandfather and my grandma. That was 10 people. But the people that lived on Astig, just about everybody had a garden. The fall of the year, everybody salted what we call a keg of fish. It was equivalent to what would be a 50-pound container of lard would be. You know, be okay. About that tall and that big around.
Okay, it's about 2.5 feet tall, maybe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they had a keg of fish. Like I say, you could get any kind of seafood. People had their gardens. Of course, the worst part was going and coming from school. Now, the lighthouse keeper, he had a boat maybe 23, 25 feet long with a little marine engine in it, but it didn't have a cabin. And he would, if it was cold, or now he had 3 daughters, and it was me. Mm-hmm. And if it was cold or rough, he would throw a tarp over us, you know, break the wind and the water off.
I bet you got down in there.
So I guess, in a way, it was primitive and hard, but we didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't realize that it was tough going.
Now, would you have some cows or anything to provide the dairy, or did you come in?
Doing what?
For the dairy, for milk and whatever, did you come to Shinkatig for that, or did you have your own cow? Or
My grandfather at one time had his own cow. Now, there was an old fellow on the island named Mr. Bill Scott, and he kept store over there. Now,
Now, when you say over there, do you mean on Assateague?
On Assateague, okay. Yes. Of course, he would take a big boat and come over to Shinkatig and get his... He would order the stuff, you know, and then it would come to East Side, and he'd bring it over across the channel. And he had a sorrel horse and a wagon. He was the only person on the island that had a wagon. All the rest of them, the ones that did have horses, they had just a two-wheel cart. The wheels, I guess the cart was about maybe 5 feet wide and maybe 8 feet long. And the wheels, they were about, I guess the wheels were 5.5 feet, you know, this way. And a horse could easily, you know, pull. Of course, the man that was owned the horse, they knew just about the ability of the horse. Now, my grandfather had a horse. He was black all over, had a little white spot in his horn. And it was half pony and half blooded horse. He wasn't all pony. Mm-hmm. He was between, well, you've seen the Shinkatig ponies.
Right.
And you've seen what we call blooded horses.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, his horse was a in between.
Okay.
But that horse would plow. He'd work at a cart. And my daddy said, I never did ride horses. Mm. My daddy could ride a horse. And he said that he had never ridden anything like that horse. I mean, he was a good saddle horse, and he'd work too. Mm-hmm. So my grandfather had chickens, and like I said, he had his eggs, and he had a big garden to get seafood. And in the fall of the year, when they would dig their turnips, potatoes, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, and they would put them in what we call a kiln, which was nothing but just they would take their vegetables and stuff and put them in a heap, and then they would cover it over with a big mound of sand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't freeze. And whenever you went there, you just dig in there and get what you want. Now, the lighthouse keeper, one of them went to what we call the sand hills. They're really sand dunes, you know. We referred to them as sand hills. And they would dig a place in the east side of that hill, which was toward the sun. And they would put just about as big as these two windows. Mm-hmm. Put two windows right in there. And the sun during the day would shine right in, and their flowers be pretty the whole winter.
Oh, wow. How about that?
And like I said, we had wood-burning stoves, and we could go into forest. And there was a fellow over there that took care of the... There was one man named Sam Field. He owned almost the whole island, you know. And the man that was the overseer, he didn't care if you cut seasoned myrtle. He didn't want you to cut the green myrtle, but you could cut the seasoned myrtle. Now, the seasoned myrtle, I mean, you wouldn't want better firewood, but it was hard to cut. Now, green myrtle cuts easy, but seasoned myrtle cuts hard. And that's what most of us burn, was myrtle wood. Now, when after you went to bed nights and the fire died down, the next morning it was kind of chilly when you got up. But it didn't take long to get... You always had your kettle and everything already, you know, put in the stove. In a few minutes, your room was warm. And now, I didn't start going to school. I started in third grade.
Did your parents teach you before that?
One of the lighthouse keeper, one lighthouse keeper had three daughters. The other lighthouse keeper had two sons and two daughters. One of the daughters taught me 1 hour a day.
And her name was, do you remember?
Her name was Pauline Westcott.
Okay.
And I was studying everything. Even had me studying geography and everything else. Because just in 1 hour, I was her...
She covered everything.
...sole student. And when I got ready to go to school, I think she came over. Said, Roy can start in the fourth grade. And the teacher says, no way in the world can we enter him in school in the fourth grade. Said, we will start him in the third. So when I started school, I started in third grade. Mm-hmm. And it was, didn't have any problem.
Good.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you something that was kind of comical. My grandfather Jones had this big patch of potatoes, and he always called me Johnny. He said, Johnny, I'll give you a quarter if you'll dig my potatoes for me. And I said, okay. Well, I took the quarter and didn't dig his potatoes. and after that, he wouldn't pay me till I did the work.
He learned his lesson.
but I shouldn't have done that. But you know,
what would a quarter buy in those days? Was a quarter a lot of money?
A quarter in those days had more buying power than today, $2.50.
Mm. 100 times. Wow.
Well, even back in 1961, you could mail a first-class letter for 3 cents.
Mm.
And now it's 37, so that's 12 times as much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was usher at Union Baptist Church when I was nothing but a teenager, and we would take the offering up, and if one of us, we had four of us, and when we came back with our collection baskets, if one of us had a dollar in our basket, we would show it to everybody else.
Wow.
I mean, the church was operating on pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters. Because like I said, if you put a dollar in the collection plate today, back then, if you put a dime in, mm-hmm. you know, that's just different. Mm-hmm. And when I was going to school sometimes, it would be two boys that would have 5 cents apiece. And they would pool their money together, which made a dime. And you could get a can of Campbell's baked beans, pork and beans, for 5 cents. Mm-hmm. You could get a box of You Need a Biscuit with these square crackers for 5 cents. And the storekeeper would give them each one a little tin spoon about that long, and they would take the top off of this can. One would take a spoonful of beans, the other one take a spoon. So they both got their lunch for 5 cents. Now, what were 5 cents? Now, back then you could take $1 and go to the store and you could buy a shopping bag that tall full of groceries for a dollar. But it was hard to get a dollar. The clams, those little neck clams, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
The last clams that I caught, I believe, I don't know whether it was 18 cents a piece, something like that. 18 cents a piece for those little necks. I've caught those same kind of little necks out of Tom's Cove. $2 a thousand.
Oh my
God. Now that's some difference.
It is.
Mm-hmm. But then, like I said, the time as you compare it, with those days, money today, you got to have a bag full of money to buy a bag full of groceries.
Mm-hmm.
but then.
Well, when did you notice the seafood industry starting to decline on Chincoteague? Was there anything that caused
the seafood industry started going downhill real bad about 25 years ago? 60 years ago, from 60 years ago on back, as far as anybody mm-hmm. can remember,
mm-hmm.
I would say 90% of the population of this island got its living out in the water. When you ride across to Astig and go over to the ocean,
right.
That area on your left as you go over, on your right as you're going over, I've seen Tom's Cove full of oysters. And people would tong, we'd go out there and tong them with hand tongs, or they would dredge them.
Mm.
And that cove would be full of oysters, thousands upon thousands of bushels of oysters.
And how many people would you see working on maybe on an average day you'd go out?
Oh, I guess it was maybe 15 or 20 of those little mm-hmm. dredge boats dredging.
Mm-hmm.
I have tonged oysters with hand tongs. Down there. Do you know where the Coast Guard station is down on the hook?
Right. Uh-huh. I've seen it from a distance.
All right. Well, there was one of the best planting grounds in Tom's Cove, right down there by that Coast Guard station. And I have tongued oysters with ice slipping right down the stales. That wasn't too balmy temperatures.
No.
But, well, I was young then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, this Frank Williams, like I was talking about, he had a boat, I don't know, she was 25, 28 feet long. And we were dredging oysters down there by the Coast Guard station. And he says, we had our suit of oilskins on, which was a pant and a jacket. The weather, the sun come out, not about as warm as it is today, and we took our jacket off. He says, Roy, says, let's get this dredge in. Look to the northeast. And when we looked to the northeast, the water had turned green, and it just white capping. And, well, the boat, I say, was about 25, 28 feet long. And it was all we could do to get across the cove. But that boat, I mean, it came up just that quick. The farther we, now when you're in Tom's Cove and the wind is northeast, the wind is blowing from Assateague Lighthouse to that Coast Guard station. A northeaster in Tom's Cove is this direction.
Oh.
A northeaster on this island is here.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been on one hurricane. We took one hurricane on one of those boats, and when you wanted to go forward to check the lines, because in a storm, if your anchor lines can chafe, and we keep old rags and stuff around them to keep them. If you want to go forward to check the lines, I had to crawl on my hands and knees. Couldn't stand up. You'd be overboard. Had to crawl on your hands and knees. Working on the water, I like to do it. I still like the water. But you've got to respect the water. I like guns. I collected guns for years and years. I like guns. But I respect them. I like the water, but I respect it. If you don't respect it, you'll get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any experiences other than that one storm where you were
Now, another incident, we were laying out in Tom's Cove. Me and my daddy, and sometimes another of his brothers would stay right aboard the boat from Monday till Friday. And when you go across to the ocean, right on your right, if the tide is down, you can see a shell rock there. And that's where we would take our oysters up, and that's where we go through them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be called calling them off.
Mm-hmm.
And our trash we threw up on that rock, and that's been building up there for years and years and years. The rock is still
mm-hmm.
there. The shell uh-huh. rock is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we were going to come in. As the storm was coming up the coast, and the fellow that owned the boat and the oysters sent word out, says, tell the boys to make a harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the boat only had a 24 horsepower motor, because at that time that was power, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's 24 horsepower. Now that 24 horsepower, even on the outboard motors, got more power than that. And when we were at that time, you know, when you go down here to the inlet view, what we call it the inlet now,
mm-hmm.
we referred to as the canal. And I've seen the time when Mr. Clarence Beebe, when he had his cattle and horses down on what we call where Ocean Breeze is now.
Right,
Mr. Clarence Beebe owned all that, had it for pasture. And what we call the inlet down there now, I've seen Mr. Clarence Beebe's cattle walk across that on low tide. And the water wouldn't be no up to their knees.
Hmm.
And that right where those cattle walked across at low tide with water knee deep is 40 feet of water down.
Oh.
And well, we had to come around the main inlet. Well, we made out fine, when we were coming in to make a harbor, there was this dragger, fishing boat. She was a good-sized boat. Mm-hmm. We were trying to make a harbor. They were going to sea.
Oh, wow.
They went to sea. We saw the boat when she was going out, but nobody ever saw her come back. She didn't come back.
Oh, my goodness.
Why they went to sea.
In that weather.
In that weather. Well, we made out fine till we got out in the Chincoteague Bay. And the motor didn't have enough power. We had this barge behind us. The boat didn't have enough power. We were going to Franklin City.
So you were pulling the barge?
Pulling the barge.
Okay.
With about 300 bushel on the end of it. We couldn't make it to Franklin City, but we made it up. Have you heard tell of Swan's Gut?
I've seen that sign. Uh-huh.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. We made it right into the mouth of Swan's Gut, and we put a great big anchor out in the marsh. And we had trees right to the windward of us. So we were making it fun. Nobody knew where we were.
Uh-huh.
The man that owned the business, he didn't know where we were. Mom didn't know where we were.
Stop right there. November 7th, 2005, we are interviewing Roy Jones for the Chincoteague Oral History Project. We're at Mr. Jones' home on Ridge Road.
And
we're going to go back to where you were taking some oysters up to Franklin City, and you were hiding in the...
The hurricane caught us, and we couldn't make it to Franklin City, but we made it to Swan's Gut.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we weathered the storm. The next morning, it was beautiful. You wouldn't think it'd ever been a storm. But like I said, Mr. Pruitt didn't know where we were, and Mom didn't know where we were. But... we made out fine. And like I said, Franklin City was a boom town. Because all the freight that was coming to Chincoteague had come through Franklin City. And all the freight that was leaving had to go through Franklin City. And, well, the man that was... There was once a steamer that plied from Chincoteague to Franklin City, mm-hmm. you know, on regular runs, and it brought the freight and all that. And it was a beehive. Then the time, and that was the time that we took the hurricane and went in Swan's Gut, and the other time we took that hurricane right out in Chincoteague Channel, and that's when I had to walk on my hands and knees to go forward.
Mm.
And the next day when we came across the bay, there were big boats all up on the dock and everything. And we were, the old saying goes, we were just as snug as can be because we had woods to the windward of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the March storm, March the 9th, I believe it was March the 9th, if I'm not mistaken.
Sounds good to me.
Just before sunset, well, we lived out on Main Street. Just before sunset, we saw that, well, I've seen the tide come up all my life, but this time it came up, and it came over the road and started spilling into yards.
Mm-hmm.
there were people that were caught on the roads. Some of them made it back home. Some didn't. Had to leave their cars where they were. The thing that caused that storm, after it was all over, the meteorologist said, what caused the storm, there were three low pressures in different parts of this country. Those three low pressures merged right over us. A stationary front formed offshore that held those pressures right here. And the tide came up and it stayed up for 3 days. I would say 90% of Chincoteague was underwater, anywhere from a few inches to 4 feet.
Wow.
And nobody had ever seen anything like it. And the meteorologist said the chances of it happening were only one time in 1 million.
Goodness.
Right after that storm, you could have taken $500,000. I believe you could have bought the whole island. A lot of people got disgusted. They moved to the mainland. And for the last couple of years, real estate on this island has skyrocketed. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. Yesterday they were talking in church that a lady up at Depot, you know that area?
Yes.
Sold her house. Of course, she had a lot of land in the back for $600,000.
My goodness.
But that, getting back to the March storm.
In 62, right?
It was in 62.
Mm-hmm.
March of 62. And nobody had. Now, I've seen hurricanes all of my life. But all you have to worry about, as far as the tide is concerned, is that one high tide. And if the eye passed, if it was at low tide and the eye passed, you got some wind, but you didn't get any flooding. Mm-hmm. Now, the March storm wasn't a hurricane. We had wind, I guess, 50, 60 miles an hour. And the wind was north. If the wind had been due northeast, it wouldn't have done half as much damage, because the wind due northeast on Chincoteague is blowing right down like this. Wind north is out here, and it just pushed all the water. It made a surge.
Oh.
It made a surge, just like along the beaches, you know. But if the wind had been due north, the wind would have
right across. Yeah.
Right on down the edge.
Mm-hmm.
But as it was off here, and it just... And particularly up there by Clark Street, anywhere from Clark Street on down, South Main Street, there were boats and barges and everything else in the road. And one fella had to keep a barge from just doing the front of his house in. You know, the water was that deep. And there was a piece of a dock. Big square piece. It was made out of, it had these big timbers underneath of it, and the decking on it was about 2x8 oak, and it was heavy.
Wow.
And it was a beating against our front porch on the. I got it out, and it went on around. But, and I went up the upstairs window and looked out, and it was everything in the world going down to where the street was. There was decoys, there was chairs, there were signs, there was boats, everything could be mentioned. People were running outboards anywhere they wanted to go. Instead of having a car going down the street, they had the boat going down the street. I had a 16-foot mahogany boat with a 40-horse motor on it, and I left that right out to the state, you know. I didn't dream we're going to have anything like that. Well, next morning when I looked, my boat was gone. So, 2 or 3 days later, a fella came up to me and said, "Roy," said, "do you know the number of your boat?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, it's Virginia 3960A. He says, "Well, it's a boat back in the woods down below us."
Oh,
said, we'll go look at it. One of the letter boards was gone, the other one was on. And we was still water, so we got her up out of the water so I could see the number board. I said, "It's my boat." The tide was high enough. They didn't have all those piers like they got now. There was only one or two on the whole front. The tide was low enough. The boat couldn't. The tide was so the boat couldn't go over it, or it couldn't go under it. You know.
Oh.
And it just beat and beat. Beat the motor off.
Oh.
Fellow live right close to me. He says, "Roy," says, "right down there by that dock was a whole heap of outboards where the boats had beat to pieces, you know, and the outboards were there in the
just
water.
Fell. Uh-huh. Fell right off the boats."
Said, do you know the number of your motor?" I said, "I can look on my insurance policy." So I got the number off my policy and went and I said, "Well, it's my motor." And Mrs. Brown from over here to Pocomo, she and her husband ran this outboard shop. I don't know whether she runs it now or not. She came over and I helped her pick up a whole pickup truck load of motors.
Oh, my goodness.
Carried mine, too. And it was beat up so bad, Frank Brown said, "Roy, I had to hide the motor." People said, "Frank, what in the world happened to this motor the way it is beat up?" I said, "Well, she came from Shantig." But nobody had ever seen anything like it. It was...
Well, did water come into your home?
The water just came in. Just like that right there on the other side of that door. Little utility room.
Mm-hmm.
The water came in that, but it didn't come into main building.
So you were fortunate.
Well, you were fortunate. But there was a fellow from the National Guard said, "You folks going to have to leave." So we went Pocomo. But we were making that all right. Because our drinking water came from the mainland. The water wasn't contaminated. And we had heat. And I stayed on the mainland one night. And the next day I said, "I'm going to go back to Shantig if I can get well." I had to go into the base and get a shot. And I came home. And I could, in the backyard was boats. It was pieces of houses. It was windows. It was everything in the world. Because there was stuff came from Ocean City. From Ocean City right on down. You wouldn't believe it, hardly.
No, I guess not.
And I've got a picture home where outboard motor boats were tied up at the rail of the Union Baptist Church. You know,
uh-huh. Just hooked on there.
People went there, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they airlifted a lot of them with helicopters. But it was a bad looking time. But we weathered it.
It took quite a while to get it cleaned up, though, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Just like these people are facing today with the storms.
But the damage that we had wasn't, as the old saying goes, a drop in the bucket to what they had down mm-hmm. New Orleans. Why? That was. And I was talking with a lady this morning, said, out in where they had that tornado.
Oh, Indiana,
I forget the name of the place, but a fella married a girl up Depot. And the same place that he lived is where that tornado hit.
Oh.
Evansville.
Oh.
And this fella that married the girl, her name is Nonna Coley. That's where he came from, Evansville, Indiana. And I said, I'll bet if she heard about it, well, Coley died, but he still has some relatives out there. I said, I imagine she's worried.
I'm sure.
Because I expect the communications and everything else is out. But getting on back down to that, there was down the bay boats. Like I said, that was a person's living. And like I said, the oysters and the clams. Shinkatig, for years and years and years, was a self-supporting community. We exported clams, oysters, fish, crabs. We sold mussels and everything. And today, what little bit of... there's a few people still working out on the water, not many. But most of them today have got into this aquaculture.
Farming the oysters and seeding the clams and that sort of thing.
Yeah, they get these little baby seed, and they put them overboard. But you have to have nets. You have to have a special net to go over those little clams.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this time of year, we wouldn't be bothered with clams. We wouldn't be bothered with stingrays or bullfish. But in the when warm weather, the worst enemy that those little clams have is the blue crab. They can take that claw and just nip the end of that little clam's shell off, and they can kill that clam. Little Tom Reed put out a whole batch of those little clams, and he didn't have time to put the net over them, and in one night's time his whole bed was wiped out. And there's a thing we call a bullfish. It's like a big ray. You've heard tell of stingrays?
Yes.
All right. Well, the bullfish is something like a stingray. And he can crush a clam like that. The bullfish can crush an oyster that size.
Oh, goodness.
Now, the stingray will fan out what we call a big hole in the flat.
Mm-hmm.
But what the stingray is after is the razor clam. You know what a razor clam is?
Yes, but you don't see them on the beach anymore like you used to.
The
shells.
That.
Mm-hmm. Real long and thin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what the stingray is after.
Ah.
The stingray isn't after the clam. Now, the bullfish, he'll eat the clam. Like I say, the fellow Mr. Bunning, I worked for the Bunning Archer Company for 40 years. And he planted oysters in Tom's Cove. And in the summertime, when the bullfish were around, he would take dynamite and go around his ground, and you could hear just boom and sea water going in the air, you know, to scare the bullfish off his oyster bed.
Wow.
But, and we go out mornings in this, we had, when we were transplanting in the summertime, we had tongue with 14-foot shelves. You know what I mean. We could tongue if the water was 14 deep. Mm-hmm. Of course, you'd have to have your hands in the water. Most times the water would be about 11 feet deep, and because we would do it at low tide. And there was a big case of dynamite at the bow of the boat. But we didn't pay no attention to it because he didn't have the caps with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that box of dynamite, if that had exploded, then I've left the bus.
But, well, it sounds like an exciting life.
And he would have these orchards planted in Tom's Cove in what we call the mud ground. And then in this summertime, he'd have about 20 of us. We would work maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and we would tong them on these boats and then go and put them on what we called the sand ground, you know.
Hmm.
They were planted in the mud bottom, and we go through them, and I mean, tong them up and put them on what they call the sand ground, because when they're put on the sand ground, they would grow a little bit faster, and most of the time they're a little bit fatter. And see, when they were planted, some places they were too thick. You know, they didn't have room enough to grow and spread out.
Uh-huh.
And when we planted them on the sand ground, they were all over the land. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I've seen oysters out there on that sand ground to be that long.
Wow. 6 or 7 inches.
A bushel of those oysters today, I bet would bring $100.
I bet you're right.
But they're not here. The last oysters planted in Tom's Cove weren't worth taking up.
Oh my goodness.
The last oysters planted out in the bay weren't worth taking up. Nobody knows. Now a lot of people, now when you go over to the ocean over here, just before you get over to the ocean part, there's water on that side and water on that side, and a little, it's like a earthen bridge.
Right.
It was a little inlet there.
Oh, they filled in.
And they put this earthen bridge across it.
Oh.
And on that side is Old Tom's Cove. Old Tom's Cove, when you go over to the park and you go to the northeast parking lot, Old Tom's Cove is right across from that.
Okay.
Well, see, there was Old Tom's Cove, and then they had these drains that went all up in what we call the levels.
Hmm.
Of course, all of that is flooding now. And when you'd have a rain, I've seen Tom's Cove, after a heavy rain, water coming off of those levels, and I had that little inlet, and I had in Big Tom's Cove, the water would look red with that fresh water.
Uh-huh.
And that fresh water is what helped to make the oysters fat. And a lot of people think when they stopped that up, and it was no fresh water coming in, is what made the oysters in Tom's Cove not so good. But I don't think that was it. Nobody knows
what happened to them.
Because Chincoteague Bay is just like that's always been. And they wouldn't live in Chincoteague.
They're not in Chincoteague either? Not in the bay?
They're
either?
Not in Chincoteague Bay. They're not in Tom's Cove. And last winter, the clams that were in the flat in Tom's Cove, all the way around until you get down to where the Coast Guard station is on the hook. From the Coast Guard station on around that whole big area, all of the clams died right in the flat. It had never happened. I mean, I've seen harder freezes than we had last year.
Right.
And what caused those clams? The people go over there and clamming, and they pull him, the clam out of the flat, and he'd be run right out of shell.
Oh.
Now, the people that had these aquaculture clams down on the hook, on the other side of the Coast Guard station, didn't bother them one bit. So some funny things are happening.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, it's just... It isn't normal.
Right. That they wouldn't replenish, die out like
they
that.
Now, you take out here in these marshes and bays clear on down.
Mm-hmm.
I talked with a fellow last night, and he said, Roy, it's a lot of little oysters out on the public grounds. But what happens, the oyster's got to be 3 inches before we can take it for market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just before they get 3 inches, they die. And well, I said, well, if it's something in the water, why don't the little oyster die?
Mm-hmm.
So, I've been around the water, underwater all my life, and I know nothing about it.
Right.
And I know how to catch a clam. I've caught oysters and all that.
Right.
And like I say, I've worked for the Button Oyster Company for 40 years. I've planted shells. And then when the little spat catches on them, get them so big, take them out in Tom's Cove, you know,
mm-hmm.
and let them grow up.
Uh-huh.
But I still don't know anything about them.
Yeah, it's a mystery.
It's just like, and I'll tell you another thing is very unusual. There hasn't been a hurricane come up this coast the whole season. Not one. And look how many they've had other places.
Right.
Well, they got down to W and then they went back to the A's. So, but not one's come here. If something, now, you take down the Outer Banks of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
well, they've got the ocean breaking in on them. We've got Astig as a barrier. I mean, the water can come out the inlet up on us, but that's not like
not
right
like
out the ocean.
Waves
on
crashing.
Yeah, not mm-hmm. like waves crashing.
But, yeah, we've seen the beach really eroded on Assateague mm-hmm, since we've lived here.
Well, get it going back like when we used to go out to Cove and stay the whole week. Joe Pruitt, he had the what we call the ebbing ground. That was ground that was go bare at low tide. Mm-hmm. And he would get oysters from James River. He would get some natural salts that came from down the bay.
Mm-hmm.
He would get oysters from what we call down east. I think they came out around Jersey or somewhere. And a fellow used to bring them down here in a schooner. Of course, the mast was in the boat, but no sails.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring them down here, and we call those the eastern oyster because they came from down east. I don't know why they call it down east, but
it's really up east.
But anyhow, and before you get down to where the Coast Guard station is, it was a big square cement foundation. At one time, it was a light on it. Well, on either side of that big foundation, inshore, he had a bed of oysters on either side of it. And it was a good ways from the inshore edge of the oysters to the high water mark. And now, where the big concrete block is,
mm-hmm.
where the beds of oysters were, it's all back in the beach. And the beach has come over until You can walk right out on it and look down and the water's right green. It's that deep.
Wow.
So where the beds of oysters were, the cement foundation and all that, it's all way back in the beach. So that's how the beach has migrated to the westward.
Uh-huh.
But as far as anybody can remember, down there where that foundation was, those flats have been just like that for, I guess, centuries. And then the beach has eroded, and the whole thing is going to the westward. Now, right up there by the parking lot, when you go over on the beach,
mm-hmm.
When you go down, when you go over on the beach and you make a right-hand turn, right on that side, you can see a little round cove. I remember from where that little round cove is over to the edge of the ocean was a good little walk. And now you can almost throw a shell from the ocean into that little cove. I mean, that's...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And another thing, it isn't only migrating to the west, it's also going that way.
Yeah.
Because in about 1900, there was no hook.
It was straight?
All of that, from where the park is now on Astig, all of that right on down, where the Coast Guard station is and everything, all of that, it had to come from the north. That sand has come from the north and is moved down like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I think it was about 1892, something like that, the presidential yacht left New York City and was going on down and go up, I believe, the James River. And the weather was bad when they left New York. The boat at that time was the most luxurious thing afloat. It had $30,000 worth of china and silver aboard. And at that time, $30,000 was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the skipper of that, the yacht was... It was schooner rigged as far as the sails were concerned, but it also had steam. And the skipper, he thought, when he saw Assateague light, he thought he was off Winter Quarter Shoals lightship.
Oh my goodness.
And he put that yacht ashore. He thought he was in deep water off breast Winter Quarter Shoals. And she broke up. And if you've been over to Assateague, where the pony corral is,
yes,
well, right on that side is a little pony trail or something like that. Well, when you get right in the mouth of that pony trail, there's a part of a cistern. And that's where the old Assateague Beach life-saving station was.
Oh my goodness.
And when the yacht went ashore, well, they had... I don't know how they got their lifeboat from the Coast Guard station over there to the site of the wreck. Evidently, it took them a right good while.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of those life-saving stations had a boat room, and most of them had two boats. And their little lifeboat was, they were every one 26 feet long. And the men had to row them. So, when the men got abreast of the wreck, some of them had come ashore in the ship's boat. And then the lifesavers got the rest of them off, you know, in their lifeboat. But the boat just went ashore, just broke right up. Is that somebody to the door?
I think it is, but probably this is a good time to stop.
We're all human. And he mistook Astig Light for a Winter Quarter Light ship. He thought he was in plenty of water, and he was on the beach.
Wow. But the president wasn't aboard then.
Oh, no.
Mm-mm. Okay.
No, the president wasn't aboard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a fella here, Captain Dan Wilton. He had a schooner named the Alberta, and he'd sailed up and down the East Coast for years and years. And he lost her right here on the hook. And it wasn't a storm. His son was with him. And, sailing ships, some of them have a big fin like under them, and some of them have what they call a centerboard. It drops down a well, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And the son said, called the old man, says, "Oh man, you better hold this boat off." Says, "Her board is hit, her centerboard is hit." "Ah," he said, "she'll come up when I call for her." But see, when a sailboat's not like a power boat. And the wind was from the south, and ever wave that would come in kept pushing her further to the beach, you know. And she went ashore, and they tried to get her off. And something happened, and the hole got in her bottom, and she sank. He tried to get her up, but he couldn't do it. And he never did get back on his feet anymore. I mean, he spent all he had.
Right. That was the end of his.
That was the end of his. Mm-hmm. He took out gunning parties and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He can take you anything you want to know.
She thinks I know everything.